industrial disputes. And the concerns they have been raising about the difference between people's pay packets and the cost of living at the moment are shared by many different industries and professions.
Nurses, ambulance drivers, teachers, postal workers, driving examiners and the like all have pay deals with the government in the pipelines and are likely to be offered less than the rate of inflation. And that means the UK's winter of discontent is likely to drag on. Saeed Pourreza, London.
Veteran Iranian politicians were present alongside foreign activists, scholars, and researchers on the second and final day of the first international conference on Martyr Soleimani's School of Thought. Panel discussions shed light on different dimensions of Martyr Soleimani's life and legacy.
You have to live with people like Martyr Soleimani to understand why they chose that certain lifestyle. Not only that, but even more important is how they choose to die. This makes people like Martyr Soleimani stand out.
According to the participants of the conference, Martyr Soleimani had a deep understanding of politics and based his views on the guidelines of the late founder of the Islamic Revolution, Imam Khomeini. They say this is the most important reason why he should always be remembered.
It is our national duty to keep the memory of Martyr Soleimani alive. He is a role model for future generations, and we need to elaborate on his school of thought for the next generation to walk down the same path.
My husband is in prison in our country, the Republic of Azerbaijan, since 2011, when he was sentenced to 12 years in prison for protesting against a ban on hijab. He was inspired by Martyr Soleimani. It is very important to introduce Martyr Soleimani to the world and the younger generation.
The plight of the Palestinians was another topic high on the agenda.
This conference is of great importance because one of the major goals of Martyr Soleimani was to liberate Palestine, and this is also one of the major issues that was pointed out in the panel discussion. It has also been mentioned in the final statement of the conference.
Eight panels separately focused on different dimensions of Martyr Soleimani's school of thought, from his personal life to his teachings and great leadership skills. However, his views regarding international politics received more attention.
I think we can highlight three points. One deals with the role that General Soleimani had in stopping U.S. hegemonic designs for the Middle East. The second point was his ability to organize people, to create networks of like-minded people. He was a religious man, he was an ethical man. He was someone that attracted people, and that was one of the reasons that he was successful.
While the organizers of the conference have decided to set up a permanent secretariat, they say they are open to receiving more research papers, projects, and books for the next conference, which will be focusing more on the legacy of a man who is known for making great efforts in eradicating insecurity in the region. Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani fought for peace, security, and stability in the region. According to the participants of this conference, his greatest legacy and achievement was eliminating Daesh terrorists. Gisumisha Ahmadi, Tehran.
While the world celebrates the start of a new year with festivities and a display of fireworks, Yemen ushers in the new year with fireworks from artillery shelling by the Saudi-led coalition. In just the first hours of 2023, Saudi Arabia carried out a series of artillery shelling in northern Yemen close to Saudi borders. According to the reports, at least 18 innocents were injured in the latest attacks. This comes after a year of bloodshed, according to the Humanity Eye Center for Rights and Development. In their latest report for the year 2022, the center revealed statistics of war crimes committed by the Saudi-led coalition. According to the report, over 3,000 Yemenis were killed and injured in 2022. Humanity Eye Center statistic and research analyst Gais Jamal reports that these crimes occurred near the Saudi border during a ceasefire.
In the year 2022, most of the crimes were committed on residents living in bordering districts with Saudi Arabia, despite the announcement of a ceasefire. The only thing that stopped was the airstrikes. However, Saudi rockets and artillery shelling continued. There was no ceasefire in the districts near the Saudi border. From the first day the ceasefire was announced, the attacks continued until this day.
Saudi Arabia and its coalition also attacked airports, Yemeni ports, and almost 15,000 homes, livestock farms, and communication stations in 2020, according to the report. Humanity Eye says it has all the evidence to prove that Saudi-led coalition committed war crimes on a mass scale.
We have met with French rights groups and presented to them reports with evidence that expose how Saudi Arabia and its allies and European states played a direct role in supporting Saudi Arabia with weapons that were used to commit war crimes on Yemenis. We presented all necessary evidence to this French rights group, and they have filed a case in court against Mohammed bin Salman and bin Zayed for the war crimes committed. This case is currently pending.
The European legal system is unlikely to bring any Saudi or UAE official to justice, which is why Yemenis want justice now.
We are calling on our government to take tough military actions against the aggressors. They are occupying our lands, destroying our homes, and killing us, and we will not remain silent for much longer. We are a free Yemeni nation with a great civilization. We have the right to defend ourselves.
The Yemeni people are suffering from the blockade and the oppression being spearheaded by Saudi Arabia. Therefore, we call on the Yemeni government to take decisive actions now to lift the blockade and end the suffering of the people.
As the conflict enters a new year, tensions are steadily rising on all active battlefronts in Yemen between Saudi-led forces and the Yemeni army. If a peaceful resolution is not reached soon, an all-out war is likely to ensue.
Pressure is beginning to mount on the Yemeni government to end the blockade imposed by the Saudi-led coalition as millions of Yemenis continue to suffer. Yemenis we spoke with are calling on the Ansarullah movement to end the siege now by any means necessary. Yusuf Mawdi, Sana'a.
This is IRIB English Radio. Website is www.parstoday.com/en.
the supplication on Tuesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, and praise is His right, since Him deserves it, abundant praise. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of my soul, for surely the soul commands to evil, except as my Lord has mercy. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of Satan, who adds sins to my sin. I seek protection with Him from every wicked tyrant and unjust sovereign and conquering enemy. O Allah, place me among Thy troops are the victors, and place me in Thy party, for Thy party are the ones who prosper. And place me among Thy friends, for Thy friends no fear shall be upon them, nor shall they sorrow. O Allah, set right for me my religion, for it is the preserving tie of my affair. Set right for me my hereafter, for it is the abode of my permanent lodging, and to it I flee from the neighborhood of the vile. Make life an increase for me in every good, and death an ease for me from every evil. O Allah, bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and the completion of the number of the envoys, and his household, the good, the pure, and his household, the good, the pure, and his companions, the distinguished. And give me on the Tuesday three things. Leave no sin for me unless Thou forgives it. And leave no grief unless Thou takes it away. And leave no enemy. And leave no enemy unless Thou repelst him. By means of In the Name of Allah, the best of the names. In the name of Allah, Lord of earth and heaven, I seek to repulse every hateful thing, the first of which is His anger. And I seek to attract every lovable thing, the first of which is His good pleasure. So seal me with forgiveness from Thee, O Patron of Beneficence.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
On January 3, 2020, former U.S. President Donald Trump directly ordered drone strikes that killed Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani and Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, the deputy commander of Iraq's Hashd al-Shaabi anti-terror force. 5 days later, Operation Qasem Soleimani. Iran retaliated by firing dozens of missiles at Ain al-Assad Air Base in al-Anbar Governorate, western Iraq, as well as another U.S. air base in Erbil, declaring that the attacks were part of its promised tough revenge for the assassination. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look back at that day, Iran's bold and courageous move, and how Iran's revenge from the U.S. is not over. First, let me introduce our guests. Saad al-Mutalabi, Iraqi politician, joins us from Baghdad. Also joining us is Zafar Bangash, director of the Institute of Contemporary Islamic Thought from Toronto.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Gentlemen, welcome to you both. I'll first start with you, Saad al-Mutalibi. Obviously, you're familiar with this incident, and it's the third anniversary of this ballistic missile attack against the Ain al-Assad air base. Tell us what you thought when that happened. What went through your mind?
Yes, thank you very much. Well, we were expecting. Everybody were expecting retaliation, a hard retaliation by the Islamic Republic of Iran, and I think the Americans also. From the information we gathered that the Americans knew or were expecting such an attack on their bases, therefore they, to minimize their casualties, they would not congregate in one area, they were spread around the camp, and they've actually dug in new trenches where they were sleeping the night, as they have explained after the attack. And so we were all expecting the attack, but I was very surprised at the severity of the attack. We did not expect that amount of missiles and the accuracy of the missiles that were used were definitely a surprise to us and naturally to the Americans, who were the target of the strikes. We felt that it is a sign or it is a first step. But I'm sure, as you very well know and everybody knows, this will not compensate for the martyrdom of Abu Mahdi Mohandas and, of course, General Soleimani. But as you know, we know and we accept that if we are murdered by the Westerner forces, the non-believers, this is automatically a martyrdom. So there's no regret on that. Uh-huh. But the regret is that we have not yet managed to gain the vengeance, or at least to see justice served to those who were responsible for this atrocity against our leaders. But as you said, as you asked, yes, that was we were expecting. But of course, it was a big surprise at the amount and the accuracy of those missiles.
We're going to talk about those missiles a little later down in the program. But Zafar Bangash, you know, when you have this predicament that Iran faced after, obviously, the assassination of Qasem Soleimani and Mahdi Mohandas, there are lots of options that I'm sure that was on the table. Of course, what I'm asking you is perhaps kind of tough to maybe respond to. But given the variety of options that Iran had decide on, what do you think about the option that it finally rested on and then executed? And, of course, the result that it had.
Well, first of all, before I address that question, I would like to put this whole issue into its proper legal context. The attack that Trump had ordered for the assassination of General Qasem Soleimani and his comrade Abu Mahdi al-Mohandas, it was a war crime. In fact, at that time, the UN Special Rapporteur for Extrajudicial Killings, Agnes Callamard, in her report submitted to the Security Council in July of 2020, she clearly stated that it was a war crime, that General Qasem Soleimani was a senior official, he was on a diplomatic mission, and therefore this constituted a war crime. I also want to remind your viewers that according to Chapter 7, Article 51 of the United Nations Charter, it clearly states that if a member of the United Nations is subjected to aggression, illegal aggression, as this was from the United States, then the victim party has the right to carry out retaliation in whatever way it deems necessary. So we need to keep these two points in mind and then look at the response of the Islamic Republic of Iran, which obviously was within its right and within its power to carry out that missile strike at the two military bases, in particular, an al-Assad military base in Anbar province. And what is absolutely incredible is that this was the first time in contemporary history that any country has been able to carry out such a retaliatory strike against the United States. If we look at the situation, for instance, in Ukraine today, the U.S. is supplying all kinds of weapons to Ukraine. In fact, missiles that the Ukrainians are using against military bases in Russia. And although Russia has warned that it is going to retaliate against the United States, but it has not done so, although Russia is supposed to be a superpower. So in fact, what the Islamic Republic of Iran did was to break that psychological barrier in hitting the United States forces and hitting them hard. But as your guest pointed out, that's not the final thing. There's going to be other retaliations coming through. And of course, we can talk about it as we proceed in the program. But definitely, this was a major, major psychological breakthrough that the Islamic Republic of Iran achieved, and therefore set an example for other countries that they can take retaliatory action against this rogue regime that is the United States.
You know, when that happened, when this attack did take place, Saddam al-Talabi, there was somewhat of an underestimation that also took place. Because initially, if you remember, the former U.S. President Donald Trump came out and said it was no big deal. We didn't suffer anything. It was just maybe some minor injuries that happened. And somewhat of a symbolic act is the type of impression that he was trying to give off. But obviously, there was a lot more to it. Let's talk about the missiles, which obviously the Americans knew that Iranians had. But they underestimated the power, because looking at the facts, it was the largest missile attack. But in terms of the missile firepower, upwards of 1,100 pounds of high explosive were these missiles in terms of their capability, and of which this U.S. base or any U.S. base cannot withstand a direct hit from these missiles, the name Fateh 313. So how was it that that was something that the U.S. underestimated, given Iran's power in its missile capability?
I think the United States underestimated Iran's power in many issues, not only the missiles. And the biggest underestimation was with the accuracy. To make big bombs, that's easy. You know, you make a big tube and you put a lot of TNT in it, and that's it. But to make it accurate, that is the hard part. And to make it fly for hundreds, or thousands, I don't know, hundreds of kilometers to a target which is the size of a blanket, and hit that blanket from so many hundreds of kilometers away, that requires an extreme accuracy. And that was definitely showed by this attack. And they weren't concentrating in one area, they were concentrating on all over the camp, the Ayn al-Assad, which in the end resulted to the almost total destruction of the camp. And so the amount of power these missiles had was incredible. And it's obvious that the Americans did not want to escalate further. Because as you very correctly said, Mr. Trump, the president, came out and underestimated the whole event. And as if it was like, children throwing stones or something like that. Because he knew that his forces were not able in defending themselves against the Islamic Republic by the numbers and the forces they had in the region. And they would definitely suffer further destruction if they were to re-escalate the issue.
Yes, Zafar Bangash, you mentioned how this has never happened before. I'm going to take a direct quote from the then Army Major Robert Hayes, who was the top doctor at Ayn al-Assad, who said, quote, "It has never happened in history that a ground force has been exposed to 11 theater ballistic missiles." And to further add to that, just a couple of testimonials, two U.S. officers they said that the strikes caused the shelter's doors to bend like waves. And another saying that the old videos of Hiroshima, where the bright light came after it exploded, and the cloud and the brightness showed itself, are just a couple of the testimonials here. Now, I'm not trying to promote the use of the missile, but the Iran's missile capability and the effect that it had, which to what statement that you made, it kind of breaks that invincibility that the U.S. Army perhaps has with this attack. What then can come out of that when the invincibility has been broken, of in this case, the Islamic Republic, making the courageous decision to attack the U.S. military base?
Well, to reiterate once again, the accuracy of the missiles of the Islamic Republic, I mean, it was actually pinpoint accuracy. The entire infrastructure, the barracks and the bases, etc., at Ain al-Asad were totally obliterated. And this is a remarkable achievement by the Islamic Republic of Iran. In addition to that, as you pointed out, initially, Donald Trump tried to sort of downplay the impact of this strike by saying, well, we didn't suffer any casualties, etc. But later on, it emerged that there were at least 100 American forces that were moved to hospitals in Kuwait who were receiving, they had suffered serious concussions, serious trauma, and they were receiving treatment in Kuwaiti hospitals. This was even admitted by an American general by the name of General Shaw, Major General Shaw. He said that our American forces did suffer those casualties. So first of all, it was the pinpoint accuracy of Iran's missiles. Secondly, the blows that were inflicted on the Americans. And third, that psychological barrier that has been broken because America got a message that the Islamic Republic of Iran is capable and willing to be able to take action against any aggression that is imposed against the Islamic Republic of Iran. And we saw that, after that, Trump basically, in downplaying the significance of this retaliation, clearly did not want to escalate the situation because he knew that the American forces are going to suffer massive casualties if Trump attempted to do that. So in that sense, I think it is a very important breakthrough in terms of contemporary warfare. And it shows that the Islamic Republic of Iran is not only capable, but it has a leadership that is courageous and is prepared to stand up for its rights and not be bullied into submissions as so many other countries unfortunately have been done. So I think this is a new paradigm. It's a paradigm shift, actually, in modern warfare. And we see now that America is gradually moving out of the region, which, of course, should be the ultimate objective of the Islamic Republic of Iran, as well as all other forces that are fighting against foreign interference, foreign aggression. So I think that process has already started, and it started with, Iran's courageous stand against the aggression that America had perpetrated. And obviously, this is not the end of it. It needs to continue in different ways, but I'm sure that the Islamic Republic decision makers will determine that as to when what the appropriate time is and what is the best way to do that.
Indeed. Let's take a look at now the impact that this has had in terms of the U.S. calculations. Saddam Mutaylabi. So we're looking at this Ain al-Assad base, which is a huge base from what we understand. I mean, it takes about a half hour to go from one end to the other. And you have this attack that's taken place. And then you have, as our guest there, Zafar Bangash, mentioned, and I'm sure you're well aware, that up to 100 U.S. soldiers suffered some major injuries, basically head traumas, concussions, etc. And also the fact that these U.S. soldiers, they weren't even safe when they went and hid in the bunker, which shows the vulnerability of the base when it comes to these missiles. So my question then is, doesn't that cause then a major shift to at a minimum, but rather it puts the U.S. in a dilemma? If their base cannot be safe from a missile attack, and in this case from Iran, then they have to change their calculations. How do you think that impacted their view militarily when it comes to a U.S. base, and in this case, in Iraq, and maybe in other parts of West Asia.
Yeah, that's why they spent billions and billions of dollars on finding new ways in combating or trying to stop missiles and intercepting flying missiles into their bases. And since 2020, as I said, billions and billions of dollars were poured into technological companies in trying to find workable methods to stop missiles falling on them. But regardless of that, is the actual event, the actual act of attacking these missiles, which created this ripple effect that people previously, we all thought that the Americans would be invincible and their bases, nobody would be able to get close to their bases. And even if they did, maybe with a small, you know, small artillery or indirect fire, like mortars or something like that. But to have this amount of accurate missiles falling on the base, that was definitely a large surprise and a shock to the Americans and to the world. That showed the amount of power that the Islamic Republic can wield at will and can deliver with tremendous accuracy into the American bases. The Americans definitely are taking a less aggressive role now in Iraq and taking a back seat in events. They do move diplomatically, politically, but as a presence of their military forces, we see very, very little amount of movement militarily, air support or ground support. We don't see any American presence now. A few years since that event, I personally haven't seen any American soldier in Iraq since that incident. So the Americans have definitely diverted their attention in Iraq more away from military intervention into a diplomatic effort, and that is possibly a positive outcome. But still, you know, the Americans, their diplomacy is not easy. We definitely need to know that their interference could be very negative in events here in Iraq.
Safra Bangash, the U.S. calculations and their approach and military strategy, obviously, it stems from their maneuverability when it comes to their bases. When their bases are fragile, in this case, in point again, because of these missiles, it has to have an impact as to how they are going to approach any militaristic adventurism that they may have, whether it's inside of Iraq or in other countries in the region. Do you think that had an impact on that?
Oh, absolutely. You know, it had a tremendous impact because if we look at it, and to reiterate, number one, the Americans did not, you know, escalate this issue. They had to back down by downplaying the significance of the Iranian missile retaliatory strike, because they knew that if they escalated this, that they are going to suffer, number one. Secondly, and I would like to link this with the American defeat in Afghanistan as well, which occurred, of course, about a year and a half that they had to run away from Afghanistan. And despite the fact that America claims to be a superpower, it has, and there is no doubt that it has enormous destructive power at its disposal, that it has a lot of weapons, etc., that it can cause a lot of damage in the country. And yet it was forced to flee from Afghanistan because it saw that despite all of its weapons, it is not able to subdue the people over there. And this was a development in the entire region. In fact, you know, if you look at some of the Arab regimes immediately after Iran's strikes on these two American military bases, both Qatar and the UAE sent their, you know, representative, the UAE sent its foreign minister to Iran to tell them that, you know, as far as UAE is concerned, it is not involved in it and it doesn't want to, you know, escalate this. It had nothing to do with it. And similarly with the Qataris, they sent their representatives to tell the Islamic Republic of Iran that they had nothing to do with the American strikes and they would like to keep out of it. So this had a tremendous ripple effect in the entire region. And I think this needs to spread further in order to drive America's intrusive actions in that region. These are destabilizing. These are not in the interests of the people. And once the Americans are driven out of the region completely, then I think it would be possible for the Muslims to deal with that other illegitimate entity, the Zionist regime. So we look forward to that day when that would happen.
Okay, now let's talk about Iraq a little bit. And Saad Motalebi, who better than to ask you this question? I mean, when you take a look at Iraq, what happened with Qasem Soleimani and Abu Mohandas in terms of the assassination that took place? The U.S. Made a decision to do that in Iraqi soil. And so many times Iran has mentioned the destabilizing, impact that the U.S. has by its presence in Iraq. But Iraq's sovereignty, its territorial integrity, was violated by the decision that the U.S. made. And hence Iran, and I believe Iran did inform the Iraqi government, went ahead and took the decision to do what it did in terms of attacking Ain al-Assad in the way that it did. But Iraq's sovereignty was first violated by the U.S. Didn't that lead to Iraqi politicians, lawmakers, and the government to then really go ahead and want U.S. to leave their country?
Oh, definitely. Yes, there were a tremendous amount of demonstrations and violence and against the towards the American presence in Baghdad and in Iraq in general. And there were a tremendous amount of pressure. The parliament voted for the immediate removal of all American forces from Iraq, but the government at the time could not. And then Mr. Kadhimi came, who was probably, I don't know, the investigation is still going on. He could be involved in this. He could, maybe he's not. I don't know. We're waiting for the evidence to be declared. But the people feeling in general was, the anger was absolutely tremendous. And the people were, and the parliament and all government organizations, they were calling for the Americans to leave the country immediately. But of course, you know, the amount of pressure that was exerted on the, at that time, the government. I mean, I remember the prime minister at the time, Adel Abdel Mahdi, he came to the parliament and asked the parliament, please vote to get the Americans out. And the parliament took that brave decision and voted for the removal of the American forces. And the numbers were reduced tremendously. I think 3,000 immediately had to leave the country. And what the remaining forces now is really just administrators and a number of trainers.
Sure. Yeah. Thank you very much for that. We appreciate it. Unfortunately, we're fresh out of time. Saad al-Motalebi there from Baghdad, Iraqi politician. Thank you. Zafar Bangash, a pleasure, director of the Institute of Contemporary Islamic Thought from Toronto. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Tahway and the team, it's goodbye.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
under the starry sky of the desert. From the very heart of evergreen forests. With the radiance of silver-colored sand. In the midst of proud mountains. Closer. Iran.
Hello, I am Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company. Taxi. My destination is Bandar Turkaman Pier. Thank you. Watching migrating birds has always been attractive to me. This season of the year is perfect for the birds migrating from the north to this island. I mean, Ashurada Island. It's one of the wonders of the nature, the way a flock of birds fly and move together. Ashurada Island is a perfect place for birds, seagulls, flamingos, pheasants, because this island is uninhabited. Iranian northern coastline is characterized with its unique, pristine nature, a combination of sea and forest. Being extended from Astara on the far west of Caspian Sea to Bandar Turkaman on its far east, it is a 660-kilometer-long coastline. Throughout the Caspian Sea's southern coastline, there is only one Iranian island, Ashuradeh. Being 40 kilometers to the west of Gorgan, capital of Golestan province, the island is a part of Miankale Peninsula. The total area of the island used to be 1,200 hectares, 800 hectares of which has submerged into the Caspian Sea. Being 26 meters below sea level, it is a mild climate island, 5 kilometers west of Bandar Turkaman. During its heyday, the locals used to do animal husbandry, bakery, and fishery. But after the island was flooded in 1993, the locals migrated to Bandar Turkaman. Being registered as a natural reserve, it is a befitting natural habitat for the region wilderness. Being so, there is a wide range of animal species in the region. Its vegetation includes raspberry bushes, sour pomegranate trees, to name a few, and its wilderness consists of fox, jackal, rabbit, fish, seabirds, pheasants, and partridge. It is worth mentioning that the region accounts for 40% of Iranian caviar fishing. Under Soviet seas in the First World War, some hospitals, residences, fortresses were constructed in the island. Through the passage of time, only one fort has remained and has been registered as a national heritage. Here's the Bandar Turkaman Pier. I have to take a boat and take a tour to Ashurada Island. It's about 10 minutes. The boatman is ready and we set off. Ashurada has a great history. It's registered internationally as one of the natural reserves in the world. It's also one of the most important wetlands in the world. A perfect natural habitat for the region's wilderness. I'm going to visit the Triangle Fortress and then I'll pay a visit to Myankale Wetland. It's interesting to note that during the safari period, this island was a hunting ground, while during the Qajari period, this island became the starting point and destination of commercial ships. Boats usually dock at the side of the wooden bridge and we have to pass over it to reach the island. At the first look, you can understand that how special this island's vegetation is. Raspberry bushes, sour pomegranate trees. Wow, unique, very special. Some historical documents indicate that palm trees, cotton, and sugarcane were also grown in this island. And here I am, near the Triangle Fortress. It used to be a military fortress in the past, with three watchtowers. The entrance of the fortress has an arched facade made of bricks. I call it oral history. It doesn't have a very special decoration since it's a military fortress. Let me walk inside. It has almost 11 chambers. Very old. And it has been registered in the list of National Heritage Sites. Oh, I can also see the fortresses built during the Safavid era from this point. Great! Did you know that's how pristine this island has remained? I have a great feeling here. Just listen. The sound of waves that reach the coast is really comforting. And look at those sand hills. They're so untouched. Wow, look at them. We have a lot of guests. I'm talking about the migrating birds. And in the last part of my trip, I have come to Myankale Wetland. Myankale Wetland is actually a heaven for the migrating birds, flying from different parts of the world. Listen. Wow. The best music. The sun is about to set, and I feel happy to be here in this beautiful Iranian island.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.